They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I am constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
All right. Thank you all so much for coming to our regulatory law event here, our second, but certainly not our least important event. As you all may have seen in my email, I affirm the fact that there's really no area of law that regulatory law doesn't cover. Whether even if it's a state issue, you just got to know whether the feds or the states do it, honestly. So this is absolutely foundational, this topic, to the mission of the Federalist Society, and it's something we're very focused on. So I'm Stephen Taft. You all know me, I think, president of the local chapter, but I'll introduce our guests here briefly. So over here we have Professor Joel Eisen, who needs no introduction. Many of you have had him.
Don't introduce
him. but I'll offer it as a compliment to the wonderful tutelage he gave me in energy law, and he's given so many of you in both energy law and leg reg, as I understand it. So he's a published scholar in numerous journals on issues of regulatory and energy law, and he knows everything there is to know about this topic, along with the other panelists here. And as it happens, he and Professor Walker here both went to Stanford Law. I just realized. I'm sure they've crossed paths, not there, I understand, but in some other situation. So they both helped us set up this event and introduce one another to me. And then over here, we have Mr. Jonathan Wolfson. Wolfson has spoken with us before. He's the head of our lawyers chapter in Richmond, and he works as the policy director of the Cicero Institute, which, as I understand it, is a kind of legal think tank devoted to the study of the regulatory state, and particularly matters such as the environment and labor. And labor was his area of expertise for the federal government when he served as a senior official for the U.S. Department of Labor. So please let us welcome all three of our honored guests here today. So we normally have speeches, but as those of you at the Dobbs event may have observed, that's challenging even with two, let alone speakers, three speakers, when we have only an hour. I would honestly devote 2 hours to both this topic and the topic last time. They both deserve it. They're all important, but they only give us an hour for the room plus change. So I'm going to focus here. I'm going to move directly on to some questions we've come up with, and I'll ask the panel, and whoever wishes to can jump in and answer them. And then when we're done with that, I'll invite you all to come up and have a chat freeform, or a cocktail party style, as I like to put it. So our first question for today, the core of the topic, is what is the major questions doctrine, and what leading cases have brought it about? Please.
Great. Well, it's awesome to be here. I've never been on campus here before. My this is the Joel Eisen campus. Like, he's like you are like the law school, and I'm so excited to be here. Such a pretty campus. So we're talking about the major questions doctrine today. We might call it the new major questions doctrine, as a couple of my colleagues have called it in a recent Wired article, because some version of the major questions doctrine has been around for decades. I'm thinking Brown and Williamson, if you remember a case about whether the FDA can regulate tobacco. Something you cover. All right. But in the last year at the Supreme Court really started to gravitate towards and ultimately settle on what I think is a newer version of major questions doctrine in a series of cases. So you have the OSHA vaccine or test mandate case, you have the CDC eviction moratorium case. In both cases, the Supreme Court held that the agency lacked the power to regulate in the way they were regulating. And then in Western Neighbors EPA, I think it really culminated where you actually had opinions that fleshed out what the major questions doctrine is now. And it's back in the court this term with the student loan case as well. But I just wanted to kind of kick us off by explaining what this doctrine is. And in West Virginia versus EPA, the Chief Justice, in the majority opinion, explains it very simply. I mean, we'll figure out for this conversation, it's actually not easy to apply and it seems amorphous. But I actually want to just read what he says and have a sense of what he says. He says, in extraordinary cases, both separation of powers principles and a practical understanding of legislative intent make us reluctant to read into ambiguous statutory text the delegation claimed to be working there. To convince us otherwise, something more than a merely plausible textual basis for agency action is necessary. The agency must instead point to clear congressional authorization for the power it claims. In other words, there are kind of two steps to the new major questions doctrine. Is it a major question? And is there clear, and if it is there clear authorization for that agency exercise it that way? So in other words, and if there isn't, the agency doesn't have the authority to regulate. And it goes back to Congress, maybe Congress actually does it in these days, but at least theoretically it's left to Congress to decide whether to give the agency that power in the first place. But I just want to really, so that you all kind of have a kind of crystal clear view, at least you're not going to have a crystal clear view. The court hasn't explained it that well. But you want to get a sense of what we're looking at. So when we're talking about major questions, in the olden days we said this was the deep economic and political significance. A major question is deep economic and political significance. In West Virginia versus EPA, both the Chief Justice and the majority opinion and Justice Gorsuch of the concurrence gave us a few other clues of what makes it major. So the Chief Justice, for instance, says it was an unheralded power in a long extant statute. So in other words, they're claiming some huge power in a statute that's been existing for a long time. That might make it a major question. It might be of great political significance if Congress has repeatedly tried to give the agency that regulatory power in other statutes and never succeeded. So you might look and see at what Congress has tried to do. Also, whether they're trying to regulate a significant portion of the American economy. Or Chief Justice Gorsuch adds his concurrence, they're trying to regulate in an area that's particularly relegated to state law, kind of more of a pro-federalism type feel. And then lastly, the Chief Justice mentions, again, we're trying to figure out what a major question is, says if the compliance costs for an industry or a law. So those are kind of major. If it is major, then you have to look for clear congressional authorization, and the court, both the Chief Justice and Gorsuch, gives a little bit of a sense on what that might look like. Justice Gorsuch says, looks at the statutory text, the overall statutory scheme. In other words, no elephants and mouse holes, as Justice Scalia once famously said. Chief Justice Roberts frames it a little bit differently and says, if the power is in an ancillary provision, so not like a major provision, but an ancillary one. Another thing they look at is the age and the focus of the statute. In other words, if you're using an old statute to do something really new and unanticipated by the enacting Congress, and perhaps not approved by the current Congress, that's evidence that there's not clear authorization. Also, look at past agency interpretation of the statute. I think Brian Williams from the FDA repeatedly said they don't have the power to do this. Might be another clue that there's not clear authorization. If the delegation is rarely used by the agency is another one, especially for major regulatory actions. And then finally, Justice Gorsuch says, and Chief Justice Roberts has said this in Kennedy Burrell as well, if there's a mismatch between agencies, the agency's mission, and the expertise and the regulatory action they're trying to undertake. In Kennedy Burrell, they said the IRS doesn't know how to regulate health markets, which I think have actually a pretty good debate on whether that's actually true, because it's true anyway. In West Virginia versus EPA, Justice Gorsuch says that the EPA doesn't have the expertise to regulate climate change, which I think is also, I think Joel might be disagreeing a little bit on that as well. But anyway, so that's the doctrine. If it's a major question, the agency is trying to regulate, follow through those squishy factors, then Congress has to provide a clear authorization. My colleagues, Dan Dinkley, let me say this is a clear statement rule. If you're kind of doing late grade, I'm not entirely sure it's like a normal clear statement rule. Maybe we'll talk about that more in the Q&A. And quite frankly, we just don't know a lot about whether the court's going to do this. It's new. And I think you're going to see both the lower courts and the court continue to flesh it out for years. So that's the intro. My answer to this will not be this long, but I think it's helpful for you all because we're all just kind of a working idea of what we're talking about.
I did just want to mention, make sure you're using your microphone because it may affect the sound quality of the recording. But thank you.
I don't know if any, if you leave, you want to add or...
But I want to jump in at one point along the way here. First of all, you just got a great summary of what the court is doing from arguably the most important scholar in administrative law today. So you gave me props, I'll give you props. Active and thoughtful on these issues, and we're going to be at this for a while. You want to use a baseball metaphor, it's the first inning of a 9-inning game. We're just getting started in thinking about what this is going to be. One thing I want to think about over the course of the next hour is what judges are going to do with this. What are lower court judges going to do with that statement that you put out there on the table? And look, 40 years ago this week, my roommate at Stanford helped found the Federalist Society chapter. And the idea back then was this idea of judicial restraint, was this idea that judges didn't jump in and create law from the bench. And there were particular lines of cases, like the cases involving the Commerce Clause, the civil rights cases, where there were scholars at the time who thought that the court had overreached. And the idea for many years was this idea of judicial restraint. And there were times when people like me wanted to jump in and say, well, you know, sometimes judges have to judge a controversy in a way that's going to bring us new court, right? But now what we have is a doctrine that one of your colleagues, Rachel Rothschild, said, it has this hodgepodge of different elements to it. And we've already started to see the lower courts interpret it in inconsistent ways. So I'm just thinking about, I looked at three district court cases where the plaintiffs tried to invoke the doctrine in the last 6 months, right? And I want you all to sit here and think about these factual situations and wonder whether any one of them would constitute a case where we should apply the doctrine. One of them was a rule by the Department of Health and Human Services decreasing Medicare payments to hospitals overall so that hospitals that weren't getting a lot of money could get more. So it's sort of socialism in hospital funding, I suppose. One of them was a Department of Labor rule increasing the minimum wage for federal contractors to $15 an hour. And one of them was a rule by the National Marine Fisheries Service requiring the fishing industry to fund monitoring programs at sea to make sure they weren't catching too much. All right. Now, if I'm going to ask everybody in this room, I'm going to pick on that ruling and say, okay, which one of those three, the court said, yes, the major question doctrine applied, not after the pick on. It was the first one. It was the first one about Medicare payments to hospitals. The other two, the court said, no, that's not a major question. Rachel said the doctrine's been invoked dozens of times. She counted 46 different times in complaints in the last 2 years, where, as you point out, it had never been all that much, it had never been invoked all that many times before. So I guess I'm kind of wondering if we're going to have this doctrine and we're going to be working with it up the line, it needs to be explained a bit better for the average district court judge to pick it up and work with it. So that's one thing. I'll have other things to say about this, but that strikes me as one area where some really good work by administrative law scholars and others is going to be necessary to stop judges from being active and picking this up and saying everything is major. And when you're a lawyer and you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. We've got this doctrine. The current court seems to really like it if you follow the oral argument of the student loan case. It's clear that that's where they're going with this one. So I would like a doctrine that provides better guidance to the lower courts about what to do so that you could honor the founding principle of the Federalist Society, which is judicial restraint. Use this sometimes when it's truly a major case, but don't use it for the monitoring program for the fishing industry.
Yeah, I'll only add, I think that's exactly right, Joel. I think the courts are getting this and what's happening in many cases. And, you know, right now it's coming mostly from the conservative side of the aisle, but that's just because of who's in office. I think, you know, when we get to the practical implications, I'll talk a little bit about when I was at Labor and how I think that's going to affect even conservative administrations in the future. But I think that everybody sees it, they hear the court kind of being interested, and they're hoping that, hey, if this is an opportunity, we'll use it. I mean, just go back to it, and I'll be the non-academic on the panel and just give you the slightly more practical. As a lawyer, part of your job sometimes is to throw 25 arguments in the brief and see which one the judge or other people might be interested in. Obviously, it'd be thoughtful. You don't want to just throw everything out there every single time. You don't do that in your appellate briefs. But there's a lot of people, especially on these preliminary injunction cases, who are like, hey, I'll throw 17 doctrines, and if I can get a district judge to issue an injunction, I'll do that right now. But I think you're absolutely right. And we need a lot more clarity. We're going to need Chris and his colleagues to help us think through this. We're going to need a lot of cases to help us think through exactly what the contours are, because you could very quickly get to a place where the administrative state doesn't have any ability to write any regulation that is not considered acceptable to whoever sits in that court seat, which could create all sorts of problems. Now, like, whether principally that's a good thing or not, like, I mean, philosophically, the founders wouldn't probably like that world where the agencies have very, very little authority. But in the 21st century, given what we've now had for basically 100 years of a pretty large and expansive administrative state, is that the world that the American people want right now? And is that the world that the American people are going to want to afford?
So I think that covers the first question well, and I think a number of our panelists touched on number two, but I'll still ask it in case there's any more to dig up there. So is the major questions doctrine something entirely new, or does it have a more distant historical or doctrinal pedigree?
I think that there's some disagreement about where it started. Some think that it started in a case called MCI versus AT&T that we'll be covering in the lightning class. But most people track it, as you did, to Brown and Williamson, the tobacco case in 2000. And it does have a different articulation today than it did in that case. That case, it seemed to me at least like the court was adding up a number of different factors. Congress had enacted a number of statutes about tobacco, but had never given the FDA power to regulate. The FDA had conspicuously showed up before Congress and said on a number of occasions, you don't have the power to regulate. And adding all of this together, the court says, well, that's the extraordinary case. That's the time that we don't want to do this. Well, if you were looking for cases that looked like that, you'd only invalidate a handful of actions today. You might look at the vaccine mandate cases and say, all right, well, that's an agency that's way outside of its normal purview. But most of the time, you probably wouldn't. You would say, we need an extraordinary case that fits all of the criteria that you were describing. So the fact that it's morphed over the years makes it even more necessary that we refine it as we go along and try to figure out exactly what it is.
Yeah, I think that, you know, in that line, right, the student loan case is probably very similar, right? Where you have the Office of Legal Counsel, you know, the solicitor and the attorney general's office is saying we don't have this authority. The Obama administration is saying we don't have this authority. You have the general counsel's office at Department of Education saying we don't have this authority over multiple Republican and Democrat administrations. And then suddenly you get people who say politically we would like to do this, good or bad or indifferent, right? The list is not about the policy itself, but whether they have the legal authority. Suddenly you move into a world where now an agency says, hey, we have this authority, we just haven't ever exercised it before. That looks like the kind of the quintessential quintessential situation that the court's going to step in. That would fit with the old, like, the historic doctrine, which is part of why it's being, you know, touted so much right now. But I think that that's exactly right. There are certain cases like that, the vaccine mandate, and I'm happy to talk about the OSHA world. Again, that's another place where, with literally months before, obviously, politics change, new administrations walk in the door. But when I had been at the Department of Labor, we had fought in court to say the Department of Labor does not need to issue an emergency technical standard, doesn't need to issue a vaccine mandate. And then there was a new administration that had a different, they're welcome to have a different opinion, but that makes it a lot harder for them to say, oh, we have this authority that we've never exercised before.
I think the one thing I'd add, I mean, it's changed a lot of ways. I think you talked around this already.
With the labor.
So, I mean, when I teach lay grade, at least until recently, when we get to Brennan Williamson, it's a Justice Conner opinion. It's so it's got totality of everything. She throws everything. She doesn't tell you what actually is, like, doing the work. She kind of looks at, because that's just what she was. She's a minimalist judge, took cases case by case. And I always tell students, though, like, if you're citing Brennan Williamson, you're out of the argument. It's like, because it was an off-the-wall argument. And so when Kiki Burwell comes around and Chief Justice Roberts cites it, I say, see, here's another example of him off the wall. And so it's weird to see in 23 years go from off the wall to on the wall. And I think one big difference I see between Brennan Williamson and the West Virginia case is that Brennan Williamson, Justice O'Connor did the hard work of trying to figure out what the statute means as a textual matter and as a structural matter. And you might not buy her argument, it's a hard argument to make. Regulating drugs, tobacco is not a drug. It's a hard argument to make, but she does the hard work of working through it. In West Virginia versus EPA, the Chief Justice barely engages with the text. And instead, I think the major questions doctrine becomes this kind of threshold canon that before we even, like, really dive into the text, if it's textually plausible, we're going to first kind of do this analysis. And I think that's different. I think that's different than kind of the earlier versions. It's much less textualist. And maybe we'll kind of get into that more as we go along, which, you know, how that fits in.
I was thinking about something Jonathan said about the agency that has regulated this way before. And I think there's a qualitative difference between the agency that disclaims regulatory authority, says, we don't have the authority to do this, and doesn't do it for the decades that a statute exists, and the agency that wants to do something new that we might think of as regulatory experimentation. I mean, I think there's a real qualitative difference there. There's a great law review article out now called Regulatory Antecedents by Rick Gervais, who's from NYU's head of OIRA now. And his point is that agencies don't always tell you in their rules what previous rules they've done on this subject. In the statement of basis and purpose, they don't always say, oh, and by the way, we've done these 10 other rules under this statutory authority. So that if a court's looking simply for whether an agency has done this before, they might look at a rule and say, well, we haven't done anything like this before. But if they go looking for the kind of fact, the kind of evidence you're trying to marshal, which is the agency hasn't done this before and has disclaimed authority and it really seems like it's out, it's an off the wall kind of argument. Okay, well then I might get more excited. But I think what's going to happen is if you tell a judge they haven't regulated this way before, anything that is a new rule that's ancillary to any kind of subject that the agency might be doing could be viewed as problematic. But if you go looking for the kind of thing you're looking for, different story.
So thank you. We'll move on to question three. What is the relationship or interplay between the major questions doctrine and Chevron deference, especially for the practicing lawyer?
So I'll just dive in real quickly. I think that, Chris, your point just a moment ago was exactly the point that, you know, really Chevron historically has been kind of the first question that gets asked was, is there ambiguity? Therefore, is the agency using a legitimate interpretation? Now the question really is, first, does the agency have the authority? Does their major questions question?
If you can make it through that analysis, then you give a Chevron. So it's kind of, it could potentially create a whole new layer of analysis that will have to happen. So which again is kind of why I think that a lot of folks were challenging regulations, and we're going to see this in, you know, 3, 5, 10, however many years it will be when the other side is now running the country, right? Which will inevitably happen, right? If anybody ever thinks that their party will always be in power, they make bad decisions that they end up paying the price for later. See the current U.S. Supreme Court and certain people who are saying, oh, I can't believe that you only have to have 50 votes to get somebody on the bench. Well, they made those decisions for themselves, right? Those decisions sometimes backfire. But anyway, the thing that people are going to have, are going to all be arguing is, these agencies didn't even have the authority to do this thing in the first place, because if they can win there, they don't even have to get into, does the statute have an opening for the agency in the first place? Because even if the statute is fully ambiguous, there's tons of places where the agency has expertise. If the department's not allowed to regulate there because of the major questions doctrine, you can foreclose all of the regulation in the first place.
We've been writing statutes that regulate the administrative state in fairly broad terms for many decades. And the idea was that an agency would use its expertise that builds up over a number of decades to fill in the gaps that Congress has left. And if this devolves into something of a clear statement rule, then there will have to be direct congressional authorization for this specific rule, and no statute could be written. Right? Even if, I mean, you mentioned congressional dysfunction, even if we assume that Congress is always on the case and always writing good statutes and always thinking of everything that might apply decades from now, we still might be in a situation where the agency is trying to fill a gap. And I think it could be seriously problematic. We're looking years ahead of time. It could be seriously problematic to have one of these fairly broad regulatory statutes and have the agency have no ability whatsoever to fill in a gap. So,
yeah, when I think of Chevron, you know, and it kind of gets back to Joel's opening thoughts. You know, Chevron was 1984. This was the Reagan Revolution to deregulate, and it had been picking up before then on the D.C. Circuit. But the Supreme Court recognized and kind of adopted this view that when it comes to statutes that agencies administer, that agencies are the ones in charge. Courts are going to make sure they don't violate the statute, sure, but with all the discretion that's there, agencies are in charge. One reason that is that they have the expertise, courts don't, and they have a process of engaging the public. And it's not legislating, but it's a lot closer to rulemaking than courts issuing decisions, so there's a political accountability lens. Part of it's national uniformity in law, that better to have one government actor say what the regulations, how they should function, as opposed to having a bunch of different courts all over the country. And so conservatives, like me, judicial conservatives, really love the idea of Chevron. It allowed for deregulation, it allowed for presidential elections to matter. And I think, at least for me, most importantly, it got the judges out of the business of making policy decisions, or being tempted to kind of make policy decisions. But, you know, since the second term of the Obama administration, conservatives and libertarians have been attacking Chevron. And I think some of the attacks are valid. I mean, Congress isn't playing the role of kind of intervening when courts don't. Presidents are increasingly using administrative law to make major policy decisions in ways that I think arguably they didn't before. Whether that's Obama or Trump took it a whole other level. And Biden, I think, is just kind of following what Trump's doing in the opposite direction. And so if you care about stability in administration, if you care about kind of the law moving slowly, I mean, these are big problems. The major questions, I completely agree, it jumps in and kind of cuts off, at least when it comes to major questions. But it reintroduces all of the problems if you care about being a judicial conservative in the small C sense, that you want judges to defer to the political branches, that you want the law to develop slowly, that you want elected representatives, including the president, to kind of be the ones that make the major value judgments. And so I don't know where we land. I think one version of it is the major questions doctrine is the kind of pressure release valve of the attacks on Chevron. Maybe. I also think it's also a pressure release valve on the
calls to reinvigorate the non-delegation doctrine, which I actually view as much more dramatic than the major questions doctrine. Or maybe this is the way that the court gets rid of both that I actually have to say it. I actually don't know where we're going, but I do think I kind of second Joel's, I'll call it an invitation, that if you are a libertarian or conservative right of center, that you got to figure out what role you think judges should be playing. And you've got a 6-3 court, so I guess maybe you can go all in with that. But some of us are going to stick to our principles that the judges should have a much more major, much more humble, much more modest role when it comes to interactions with the other branches.
I'm fond of telling classes that I was actually taking an administrative law course when Chevron was decided.
Wow.
And we literally threw out the syllabus and spent 7 weeks talking about these great issues that you raised. And, you know, I remember from the beginning, Chevron wasn't even really the Chevron doctrine for the first 3 years, and then all of a sudden it got picked up and became this two-step doctrine, became the law of the land. But I remember folks on my side of the political aisle being extraordinarily upset that liberal judges were now going to have their hands tied by this two-step machination of that the agency is going to win now, and it's going to win more often. And I could not be more in agreement with you about the idea of judicial conservatism with a small C. I think when we're dealing with major problems in this country that need some sort of solution, leaving this all up to Congress to somehow provide all of the details for things like how we're going to have, oh, I was talking to my class yesterday about a national electric transmission grid, how that's actually going to happen, is not something that Congress can do. And I'll tell you one thing I do worry about is if judges go too far with this. Some folks have written, this was the Yale Journal on Regulation blog post the other day, some folks have said, well, Congress won't be ambitious in trying to write statutes because members of Congress will know that whatever they write will get picked apart in the courts by judges who are actively trying to make sure agencies don't do much. So I worry about that.
So we'll move on to question 4. How relevant is statutory ambiguity to both the major questions doctrine and Chevron deference? And have statutes become more ambiguous as well as more numerous over time?
I kind of touched on that already about the ambiguity.
Sure.
I actually think it's the kind of opposite in the sense that we don't have a lot of new statutes. We don't have Congress reauthorizing statutes and government agencies that would actually flesh out. No, I mean, sometimes we do. Like, in the FAA context, they actually have reauthorized statutes and give them power to regulate drones and do better airports. And the USDA goes to regular reauthorization as well. But for the most part, I think you're dealing with statutes in the environmental health and safety, which is more your area, that haven't been changed much since the 1970s. And yet the problems have changed a lot. And agencies are kind of confronting new problems with old statutes. I think that's where you're seeing a lot of the action. So instead of saying there are broad grants of authority in lots of these, I mean, like if you look at the EPA scheme, and I think what's really a case, a hard case. Some people disagree on both sides. It's a hard case, but like, you look at it, Congress is trying to give a ton of power to the EPA to deal with a little different problem with climate change, to deal with kind of air pollution more generally. And they did it very properly. And they didn't really kind of put the limits that, and I think that's one reason why you don't see the Chief Justice go too far into the text, because the text is a, so there's a lot of power that the EPA's given. I don't know if you have thoughts on that. Or...
Well, I'm certainly going to agree with the first half,
yeah.
Which is, I teach my students about the Federal Power Act. It was written in 1935 and hasn't been amended all that much since then. There were some amendments in the 70s. But the basic statutory command of many of the environmental health and safety regulation, that's the 60s and 70s, and to some extent. The last major environmental law of any real consequence was in the 1990 Clean Air Act amendments. We've been living, you're right, we've been living with laws with broad grant of authority to agencies for quite some time. That reflects the congressional mood that the agencies are best equipped to handle these big problems. So the real question comes in when an agency does something where you would imagine that the agency has gone wrong. And West Virginia versus EPA for me is not one of those cases. It's not one of those times where an agency has done something that's not within its purview. I might look at the CDC and the CDC moratorium case. Mm-hmm. I might say, well, okay, that's something where an agency is doing something it just doesn't do. But I think if we ask everybody in this audience, what does the CDC do? We're not going to say that it impose a moratorium on landlords kicking people out because it has something to do with COVID. So I tend to think of West Virginia versus EPA as the hard case because there were many different efforts, the Clean Power Plan and others, to try to get at emissions in the electricity sector. I would love to have a doctrine that's reserved for those relatively rare instances where the agency appears to have gone wrong. That's what I'm.
Can I ask real quick on that? How much do you think it's really about Massachusetts versus EPA?
In other words, the landmark case recognizes that EPA has the authority to regulate climate change and greenhouse gas.
In my mind, I felt like Chief Justice Roberts was kind of relitigating that. Because I agree with you. I think the Clean Power Plan after Massachusetts versus EPA is on the books. It's not a major question. It's just not. I mean, could they have done it on a contextual matter? Maybe. There's some argument. I think it's actually not the easiest case. But Master's EPA, I wonder if that's kind of what was really going on.
Well, there's another line of analysis that I saw last week about West Virginia versus EPA itself. And that is, if the decision had been written to invalidate the EPA's authority over climate change generally, it would have affected the reasoning in AEP versus Connecticut that displaced common law lawsuits, the nuisance lawsuits that are now ongoing. So for those of you who wonder what I'm talking about here, there are a lot of lawsuits out there that are using common law nuisance theories to try to hold big corporations responsible for climate change. In 2009, the Supreme Court effectively displaced most of that in a decision called AEP versus Connecticut, because the court said, well, after Massachusetts versus EPA, we have this scheme of regulating climate change that where the EPA is going to act, and then eventually it did act with the endangerment finding and so forth. But if you say in West Virginia that Massachusetts is not good law anymore, you're basically inviting all of these nuisance lawsuits to come right to the fore and hold Exxon and others responsible. So I think that might have been, some people have speculated that that's part of what was going on there.
Yeah. But I'm curious about the ocean one. Is that another good example?
Yeah, no, I think it is, and that's an interesting point on the AEP versus Connecticut. I did a lot, in my private practice, I did a lot of defense work on some cases that were related to that, and we were citing AEP versus Connecticut a lot. So that's a fascinating point. I think two things I would just mention. One is, I think that the challenge is, and you're probably right, Chris, that a lot of this is relitigating the historic decision where the court steps in and basically is like, oh yeah, greenhouse gases count as a pollutant, maybe, right? But the Supreme Court says they do, and so now suddenly EPA starts walking down that path. When I think everybody knows, if you had put that up to a vote in Congress, it would not have passed. At least not at that point in time. Maybe it would pass today, but like at the point in time that the Massachusetts case goes through the Supreme Court, if you would have said, does the EPA have authority over greenhouse gases, I think that it would not have been able to pass Congress. Like, assuming that you forced, like you could figure out a way to force that vote. Like, assuming you have no filibuster rules, like you actually put it up for a vote, I think that there are a lot of red state Democrats who would have voted against it, and you would have seen
even a lot of blue state Democrats who would have looked around. For example, in 2016, San Francisco was still being powered by a coal-fired power plant, right? So like this is like, it's really a more recent phenomenon that we're there. So part of it may be this reaction of, if we all know that Congress would not, assuming that it actually could get to Congress, that Congress wouldn't pass a law like this, is this the court, again, not little c conservative, is this the court stepping in and being like, look, we know that there's no world in which the legislature would pass a law like this, so really would Congress today want those agencies regulated? I think that the OSHA is, you know, again, one of those really great examples where the OSHA Act is a really old statute. It doesn't get updated very frequently. This is also true with the Fair Labor Standards Act. And, you know, it's all the wage and hour regulations. All that is built off a statute that's from the 1940s. And it's been updated a couple times in the 60s and 70s, and not like the whole statute updated, but little pieces. So when we were working on, for example, the independent contractor regulation, what we were doing was we were basically saying, well, here's the statute defines employer and employee. It doesn't define independent contractor. So you're having to now create a rule that says, well, here, how do people fall outside of the definition of employee, and how can a company fall outside of the definition of employer? That's the body, that's the world that is an independent contractor. If you were to, again, if you could get it before Congress, would Congress pass this as a statute, what we put in as a reg on independent contracting? I don't know. Like, I think that becomes an interesting question. And so, but OSHA decided they're going to impose a vaccine mandate. You know, OSHA's requirement for imposing regulations is things have to be imminent harm. And I'll be frank, at the point you have a regulation that applies only to businesses with in excess of a certain number of employees, it stops looking like imminent harm. It starts looking like you're making a policy choice, which they're welcome to do. But again, if you've never gone down that path before and you're suddenly making policy decisions, it's going to be a real challenge when you show up in the courts when you have a ton of political opposition to that sort of decision. You know, it'd be one thing if there was widespread consensus that a vaccine mandate was beneficial or that it was going to have huge beneficial effects on businesses being able to stay open or any of those sorts of things. You know, in some ways, OSHA may have been able to more easily do a mask mandate, where they would have been able to say, we're going to mandate that every business has to provide their employees with masks, and we're going to require every employer to require their employees to wear masks, because that looks a lot more like kind of the quintessential OSHA thing, right? What does OSHA do? They say at a construction site, if somebody's working anywhere above 6 feet off the ground, they have to be tethered. That looks like a safety thing that you would expect people to do, whereas OSHA doesn't usually step in and require that employees at businesses take tetanus shots, for example, despite the fact that employees would obviously be in danger in certain industries if they didn't have those tetanus shots. So requiring employees to take particular actions to protect themselves, especially given all the other controversy around the vaccine, that becomes a much harder question. When it becomes a hard question, then it starts looking like major questions doctrine is going to be implicated.
So this question five may be our last one we have time for, but I'll go into it. What is the relationship between the major questions doctrine and leading theories of statutory interpretation, such as originalism or textualism?
So this is a really important question. I mean, so especially in a law school setting where you're kind of figuring out, you know, how should judges approach interpreting legal texts? And you know, I tend to be a textualist in the sense that I kind of start in with the text. Of course, that includes the structure and context and kind of backdrop law against which Congress enacts that statute. And I'm not a fan of substantive canons. In other words, I'm a fan of textual canons that talk about what the law is, how Congress drafts, kind of assumptions about how we make law, what we think law means. And I'm a fan of that because, one, I think that is, to some extent, what Congress actually does. But even more importantly, kind of rule of law values and sets clear rules of the road so that we can all order our affairs around what that law is, and Congress knows these rules are going to apply. Substantive canons aren't that. Substantive canons are more shoulds, not is. In other words, think constitutional avoidance or rule of lenity or pro-federalism canons. They're not about how the court thinks that Congress actually drafts. They're about values that the court has that imposes on Congress to encourage them to draft in ways to address those issues. And I think the major questions doctrine is a variant of that.
So I think it's a textual matter for me. I have a hard time squaring it with ordinary statutory interpretation. And so those of you that aren't substantive canons fans, I think you probably, hopefully, are also kind of wondering. Now, there are textualists that love substantive canons. Justice Gorsuch is one of those. He invokes them early and often, which seems kind of weird because he's also a very formalist textualist. I mean, compare Bostock with West Virginia versus EPA, and it's hard to reconcile those unless you have a firm belief in a substantive canon like the major questions doctrine. Now, if I'm a purposivist, this should be like one of my favorite canons, the major questions doctrine, because it is trying to get at what you think Congress was trying to do. That they might not have effectively accomplished in the text, but it's there, and it's interesting that you don't see a lot of purposivists kind of jump up and say, I love this canon. And as an originalist, man, I think Justice Gorsuch would say, this is about non-delegation. I go along with this because I would strike both these down on non-delegation grounds. I will note that when I started with it, Chief Justice Roberts actually frames it more in terms of separation of powers. And I'll give my pitch for this and I'll stop. I actually think he doesn't just view this as non-delegation. Maybe I'm way overreading.
Does not
about just non-delegation. I think he views this as about delegation and about the role that each branch should play. In other words, I think he views Article 1 as charging Congress to make the major value judgments, as the president to largely implement those value judgments within the space that Congress has given the discretion, and the courts to play a role to control those boundaries that the president, and I'm kind of borrowing a little bit from Dan Farber here, who has this great blog post saying, maybe the major questions doctrine is to fight back against presidential excessive, you know, behavior, and not necessarily to give power back to Congress. And so I think that's what's going to be fleshed out, and I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see scholars and Chief Justice Roberts flesh that out more. It's not just going to rise and fall into non-delegation. I don't think it can, if that's your kind of underlying. It sweeps too broadly. It doesn't really capture what non-delegation is about. And if we had another one, we could hold a different bit on that. I do think it does resonate as a policy matter, at least, under separation of powers. In other words, as a textualist, I don't know how we get it and why it exists. As a policy matter, some version of it, not that necessarily as muscular as a West Virginia University PA, is a really good doctor. So these are the things you struggle with as lawyers and law students. It's like, again, as a policy matter, I really like something, but as a legal matter, really struggle to try to find a place for it within the tools that you think judges should appropriately use when they're deciding cases. So
I guess that'll be my closing argument. I don't know.
We have a little more time. But I'll just kind of get that out there, because if you are a textualist, I hope you're struggling with this, because I don't think it fits naturally within a normal textualist framework for interpreting statutes.
Wow. I'm going to agree with all of that. except, look, I'm no textualist. I went to law school at a time where legislative history actually did have some role in the judicial process. And I tell my students it doesn't now. And we could argue all day about whether textualists actually impose their policy preferences in their own decisions, but it's the law of the land now, so let's leave that as it is. You've given me something to think about, which is, if you tend to think of the major question doctrine as something of a substantive canon, would it be disfavored in the courtroom as any other substantive canon would be? Or if it's limited appropriately so that it's not as broad as all outdoors, would it be something that somebody like me would actually support down the line? And I have to say, look, in these early days of the new major question, people like me are just angry. but I want to focus that, because there is this 6-3 majority on the current court, I want to focus that to develop this doctrine into something that can be useful, frankly, to everyone. We should entertain student questions.
Yeah, I think perhaps if you don't have anything to add, Jonathan, if you do, please.
I'll just say one thing super quickly, but yeah, I want your question more. I think that, to your point, Chris, the purpose of this are upset right now, but I think that this is going to be the practical implication. I think that when people like me are sitting in agencies again in a Republican administration like I was, I think this doctrine will tie our hands in a lot of ways that a lot of folks on the left will like. I think that right now, there are a lot of folks on the left who don't like like major questions doctrine, because it's getting rid of, say, EPA power to regulate power plants. But I think on the flip side, it's going to tie the hands of a future Republican administration that's interested in deregulatory efforts, because the argument's going to be this department has never taken action to not regulate this thing before. OSHA has never taken a step to say we don't have to step in and do this regulation. We'll leave it to the courts to ultimately allow, you know, workers' comp and tort suits to solve this problem. So I think that you're going to see a lot of people's hands tied. Right now, again, it's the brand new doctrine, so the people whose hands are tied right now all happen to have a D on their shirt, because there's a Democrat in the White House. But there will be a lot of people whose hands are tied. If I walked back and did the exact same job I was doing in the Trump administration, I think that there are regulations that we put in place that we would call deregulatory that I'm not sure we would have been able to get through through the major questions doctrine either.
That's really interesting. So I found this absolutely fascinating, and I'm going to watch the recording of it as though it were a class that I missed. I'm not kidding. And it will appear on the Article 1 podcast of the Federalist Society, as far as I understand. I'll make the recording available in numerous other places as well. So please give our guests a round of applause.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.